Hello, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 16 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Dr. Justin Winzenberg and me, Stephen Jones. Today we are joined by Dr. Holly Beers, who shares with us about how better understanding women in the first century context can lead to better readings of the Bible.
So what was the highlight for you this week?
So the highlight for sure was that for the first time this year, Jenny and I were able to eat breakfast up on our deck this morning.
Nice.
And so it was just nice. I don't know. It's one of the things I'm going to miss most when we leave this house is after a few years, I mean, it was probably 5 years that we didn't really feel like we could use the deck because the decking was so, you know, like some places you're like, is my foot going to fall all the way through that? And then we replaced the decking a couple of years ago, and it has become one of my favorite things about the house. And so to be able to sit out there and hear the birds and, you know, beautiful weather and nice cup of coffee. Right. And also she made chocolate chip scones, which
That sounds good.
It's just, and they were still warm, you know, it's just, anyway. Yeah. So that was a highlight for me.
That's great.
How about for you? What's the highlight been?
For me, I got an unexpected, a delightfully unexpected text message from an old friend. He was a youth leader of mine back in the day. We overlapped actually in our undergraduate work by about a year, but I hadn't seen him in a long time. And then all of a sudden I hear that he's coming to campus with his daughter for a campus visit.
Well, how about that?
And it was so cool. I didn't get to see him and his daughter for real long, but man, it just brought back a lot of good memories.
That's
and it
great.
Was really good to catch up with him. But what it made me realize is, oh boy, I'm now in this very interesting stage in terms of teaching where all of a sudden people that are my friends, their kids are now visiting college. So mm-hmm. For a long time there, when I was an adjunct, I was like just barely older than the students.
Yep.
And that day is gone. So I've known that for a while, but it kind of feels more of a reality when you're like, now your friends' kids are actually visiting
right.
college. And your college, and it's like, okay, well, I guess we're there now. That's not a bad thing. I don't fear getting older, but it's certainly a sort of a reality check.
Yeah, it makes sense. What's a low light been for you?
Well, you know, I told you about this a bit, but we have a loved one, unfortunately, who's been in the hospital with COVID.
Right.
She seems to be doing well, but I think it's kind of a sobering reminder, you know, now that vaccinations are becoming more prevalent, and now that I think, you know, things have been opened up a lot more, I think there's a sense almost in a lot of our brains that, oh, it's gone
right.
and everything's okay now. But there are still people who are getting it, and there's still people who are being hospitalized by it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hitting close to home for us, but it sounds like so far today she's doing pretty well.
I'm glad to hear that.
But it sounds like, you know, things are on the upside and we're optimistic.
Oh, that's good news. I think it really is what you're describing is really familiar, this sense of like, because it feels, I mean, I think it's the combination of spring, you know, so it feels like we've moved into a new season. And so it's like, you know, surely we've moved past this other thing. And there's been enough good news recently that it's hard to remember that, no, this is still very present. And of course, none of us want it to be present. And so it's easy to wish it away. But
and it's easy to forget sometimes. There are certainly other countries in the world at the moment who are on absolute lockdown still. So for us here in the US, things are opening up. But yeah, I've heard stories from friends who are saying, no, we're still on lockdown. And it's like Italy went on another lockdown.
Right.
So, you know, globally, the situation is still pretty murky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and then the whole question of vaccine equity, right? Like, I mean, there's, gosh. Yeah.
Yep. So what's been a low light for you this week?
I think there's just been this swirling chaos in my life this week. And it's so we had a few weeks on the road, which felt awkward for the reasons we were just talking about, but seemed mm-hmm. necessary. But anyway, as we came back from all of that, there's kind of this realization, like we had talked about listing our house on the market at the beginning of April. And it's like, oh, it's the beginning of April. And there's just so many decisions that we have to make. It's constant decisions. And there are decisions that depend on decisions, you know, as we get ready to move here. And some of the, and we're definitely getting contradictory advice from people who have done what we're doing before us, like almost 100% opposite advice sometimes. And so it's I don't know. And so I guess in the midst of all of that, it's making me very tired. And I have days where I just don't feel like I can think clearly. And then I have days where I'm, you know, feeling pretty good. yeah, but it, I don't know, trying to move forward on projects like the dissertation. I've got a couple of books that I'm working on revising that I'd really like to get done before we go. And then there are moments that I'm like, should I have just spent the day doing that when I, you know, still have, I don't know, like today I took a load of shredding stuff to the dump, you know, like, yeah, you know, it's like that, that kind of stuff that just feels like there's all of this, yeah, to do and not really a clear pathway through it. So I, that's the low light for me.
Yeah, that's tricky. Well, what's an insight then that you have from this last week?
Okay, so this is also from today. I, as I was standing around, I was making omelets this morning for me and Jenny, and I was, we were talking with the kids, and I don't know how this came. Oh, we were talking about gas prices. That's what it was, because we had just filled up the van. And at some point, we got to talking about how in both 2005 and 2007, Jenny and I had spent the whole summer on the road, that we actually didn't have a house either of those times. 2005, it was on purpose. We just graduated from college and we were like, hey, we don't really have jobs. We don't have a house. Let's live on the road. Let's camp. And we spent a month in Mexico with a group of students. You know, like, we also spent time in Canada that summer. Like it was really good. 2007, we ended up not having a house, not on purpose. And so we found ourselves kind of wandering and really, and not, and didn't have a job either. It was the first time that I taught in Mali. So I took a group of students from Mali to Mali and taught them. And I was there for about a month. And then when I came back, we were, yeah, just on the road camping and whatnot. And here's the, but our daughter was with us that time, but the boys weren't. Mm. And so we, yeah, here's the insight. My kids don't know me. Like they don't, there's these things that I just assume that they know about Jenny and I. And I realized like, oh, there's no reason they would know that. Like Jenny and I camped a ton when we first got married. We have, I don't think we've taken the kids camping since we've been in Minnesota. And I'm just realizing like in my mind, oh yeah, we're people who camp a lot. And in my kids' mind, they've never known us to camp hardly at all. So yeah, I don't know exactly what the insight is, but it's like, yeah, just this realization of like, oh, who they imagine me to be and who I imagine me to be are like totally different people.
You know, I had a very similar thought recently when, I mean, I was playing in sports leagues all the way up until literally until my first son here was born about 4 years ago, then I stopped playing. And so then I realized that like my sons, neither of them know me at all as like an athlete.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
I mean, I'm sure they know that I'm interested in it, but they've never seen me play a sport ever.
Right.
You know, really not in any organized sense. So it's funny. I contacted a buddy and I'm like, hey, if you got any openings in your softball league, like, count me in. Cause I want to get out there and run around a little bit, but also cause I'm like, hey, you know, it'd be good for my kids to see their dad be a little more active than just sitting around.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a similar thought, like, man, my kids don't even know that. Like they just assume that I'm, you know, something other than that.
What's an insight been for you this week?
Well, you know, we're recording here on an interesting day because, you know, we're in the midst of Holy Week and Good Friday was yesterday. And of course, Easter Sunday is coming tomorrow. And, you know, I've been posting some thoughts about this on Twitter. So I apologize for any of my Twitter followers. You might be kind of hearing repeats, but
it's just double dipping. That's all.
It's double dipping. I don't ever remember, you know, since from the time I started going to church until somewhat recently, I don't ever really remember hearing anything about the day between the crucifixion and the resurrection. And it was really a book that I read in seminary that started to get me thinking about it. But, you know, I always think now that like this is such an important day, this Saturday in between crucifixion and resurrection. And some of it is that if I were a painter, and I'm not, I'm absolutely brutal at artwork, but if I were, I think I would paint like the disciples. There'd be Peter over here. This would be Holy Saturday in my mind. Yeah. Peter over there, absolutely passed out from being pissed drunk. And then you got, you know, Mary over there and she's got a needle stuck in her arm. And then you've got John over there and he's got a couple of women. I mean, she's been doing drugs.
Oh, okay. Okay. Sorry. Yeah.
Thanks. I'm sorry. You know, I maybe been watching too much Breaking Bad lately, but
I was so just imagining that she was having a bad day sewing.
No. Sorry.
Okay, got it.
Different kind of needle. And then John's over there and he's got maybe he's laying in bed with a couple of women. And that's a really disturbing picture. And to be frank, there's no biblical evidence that such a thing happened.
Sure.
But the reason why I think it's an important imaginative idea is I tend to think like, like, what do human beings do when absolutely all hope is lost?
Right.
And I'm like, when you're in your absolute worst self, and I mean, it can lead you to all sorts of forms of despair. And I have to imagine that they woke up, that all these early followers of Jesus, male and female, woke up that Saturday morning, just devastated and crushed. And I can't imagine what life was like for them that day. But what's so important about it, and why I've been reflecting on it, is because it's made me realize the significance of Easter, which is that somehow true faith can sometimes emerge out of the death of faith.
Hmm.
You know, true faith can sometimes really emerge out of the loss of faith.
Yeah.
So I tend to think that maybe those first followers of Jesus woke up with no faith that morning. I mean, the absolute loss of faith. And Saturday didn't have the last say, but it's an important reminder, because I'm thinking about some of these conversations we've had about deconstruction, right, and people who've been through painful and even traumatizing experiences with their faith communities. And sometimes I think it can, and not everybody experiences that, maybe that sense of despair always. Sometimes it can feel liberating, mm-hmm. but I think for those who do experience that despair, I find it comforting to think that maybe the first followers of Jesus went through something similar.
Yeah.
It's speculative, because there's not a lot in scripture talks about it, but I have to believe there's some likelihood to it.
Right. It also makes me think of, you know, Jesus compared the sign of the resurrection to Jonah's experience, which is interesting. but thinking about Jonah while he's still in the fish, right? And I think there's this, I feel like we jump from Jonah being like, okay, it's me, throw me into the sea, to Jonah, you know, kind of pouting outside of the walls of Nineveh, right? But there's like this really critical space, that liminal space, that marginal space, that's neither the new thing nor the old thing. And I feel like maybe what's so important to me about that space, the in-between space, is that I feel like that's where we live so much of our lives, right? Like that, you know, if you want to use the already but not yet language, or, you know, whatever, but we're no longer who we were, what we were. We're not yet who we will be or where we will be. And we're in this in-between space, and how we live in that in-between space is really interesting. Like, there are moments that there's hope and there's moments that there's despair. I don't know.
I have to imagine that. So Sunday comes, disciples, you know, realize Jesus is risen, which, by the way, isn't good news for everybody. I can't imagine how Peter would have felt. Like, in some ways, I kind of feel like, man, Peter must have thought, like, are you kidding me? Like, not celebratory, but right. Like, now I have to see him again after what just happened, right, those three denials. I'm not suggesting it really wasn't good news for Peter, but yeah, I could see how it would be some tension there. And so we almost assume, like, oh, all of their questions are answered on Sunday, and they just go to utter ecstasy. And yet there they are, like, gathered.
Well, and clearly all their questions weren't answered, right?
No way. And so I have to feel like while Sunday kind of comes and maybe the despair wanes a bit, like, all those lingering sentiments from Friday and Saturday had to have still kind of, they had to have been feeling it. Yeah. I mean, they just went through this, like, devastating, like, you know, a truckload of doubts and fears and all this other stuff and disappointment with God. And so I can't imagine it went away overnight.
Right.
Which is interesting then, because then what would faith look like that day? It wouldn't look like, you know, saying, oh, I've got it all figured out now. I don't know. It has me thinking a lot about expressions of faith as well, and how those can occur even in the midst of these terrifying moments and lingering senses of God's absence.
Yeah. Hey, guess what? It's been a year, almost a year, since we released the first episode.
Wow, man. That's crazy to think about.
Yeah, it was.
I can't believe it.
I, if I've got my dates right here, it was April 9th of 2020 that we released the first episode.
That's cool.
Yeah, this one's coming out on April 5th, so it's a year. Congratulations.
Wow, yeah, congrats. This has been a wild ride. How many episodes do we have total that we've done?
I think this is episode 37.
Wow, man, 37.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And we have talked with some fascinating people. over the last year.
Yeah, we have.
Yeah. If you haven't had a chance to look through the back catalog, it's worth going to profsandrooms.com to check it out, because it's just, yeah, just some really fun folks that we've had an opportunity to talk with. We also wanted to let you know a little bit more about our Patreon site, which is at patreon.com/profsandrooms. Every month, we post bonus content, including excerpts from our conversations that don't make it into the show. We also sometimes have exclusive content that we make only for Patreon. For example, in today's episode, the issue of slavery in the first century comes up. On Patreon, Justin and I have a long conversation about what the existence of slavery in the first century means for interpreting the New Testament today. Our subscribers can access that and plenty more content at patreon.com/profsandrooms. As always, anyone can find out more about the podcast at profsandrooms.com. We'll be back in a moment with Holly Beers.
I can't tell you how excited I am today to have Dr. Holly Beers with us here. She's Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. Now, you actually are one of the folks who've transitioned away from the terrible weather in Minnesota to the sunny weather in California. So you probably made a smart decision there. But you also teach, or you teach New Testament and Greek courses. But I know you love to research, you love to write, and you have a passion for teaching and mentoring students in their various stages of faith development. She sees her academic work as her primary way of serving the church and believes passionately in the local church as a hub for God's kingdom work in the world. Holly is married to Max, and they have three elementary age children with Old Testament rather than New Testament names, Noah, Moses, and Eden. And I've never had a chance to ask you how you decided on Old Testament. Testament names.
Well, fair enough. I mean, I met Max, my husband, in seminary at Bethel, and yep. He's actually always been more passionate about the Old Testament than the New Testament. So that's probably part of it. But because so many of the Old Testament, you know, images and texts and themes come through to the New Testament, I was okay with Old Testament names. So this is what I tell my students. I say, we named our boys Noah and Moses because of our confidence in God's commitment to the covenants. So when God covenants with God's people, God is in all the way, and we can trust that as the people of God. And then we named Eden, our daughter, Eden, because basically the Bible opens and then closes with these images of Eden. Mm-hmm. And she's our family reminder of God's commitment to restore creation. So
that's cool. Yeah. It's so interesting thinking about naming children and going through that process now that I've been through it twice. And it's so nice when you can have a important meaning to your kids' names. I appreciate that. Well, hey, we're excited to have you here. I'm excited to see you again. For our listeners who probably don't know, you know, you and I, we've crossed paths over the years in that we went to seminary together, started PhD work together. And then you very more quickly than I finished your PhD, much more quickly than I. we crossed paths in that way. And I'm just excited to converse with you here today. Holly, thanks for joining us.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So something we like to ask our guests, do you drink coffee? And if so, what's the best cup of coffee you've ever had?
Yes, I drink coffee. Yes, I do. And this, my answer to this is going to be honestly such a mom answer. I am kind of a coffee snob in that I don't enjoy just anything, but really my best cup of coffee is one that I didn't have to make for myself. So
if hey, I'm there you go.
Out you know, at a decent coffee shop, that might be my best cup of coffee I've had up to that point in my life.
Nice.
Can you compare the coffee you've had? Because you had some good coffee in the cities. I mean, you're living in Northeast when you're here in Northeast Minneapolis. Can you compare the coffee that you've had like in Northeast Minneapolis compared to out in California?
I would say, I mean, we've got a couple of local, you know, independently owned coffee places here in Santa Barbara, and they feel very familiar to me in terms of what I experienced at the local places in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
So very, nice. Yeah, very good. And very much a kind of independent personality in terms of the like space and the flavor profile, if that's even the right way to talk about it. I don't know.
Oh, that's great. Well, we're excited to talk to you on a couple of fronts here today. We want to have a chance to speak with you about your most recent book that you've published, a fascinating subject and an interesting look at a week in the life of a Greco-Roman woman. And then we also want to have a chance just to talk about some of your passion pastorally for talking with students and in your teaching. So maybe we can just start by asking you about your book. Is that okay?
Well, of course. What do you want to know?
So your most recent book, Week in the Life of a Greco-Roman Woman, is very unique, I think, because it does two things. It takes like this rigorous scholarly work that you've done in terms of women's experiences in the ancient world, but then it sort of provides that look through providing a fictional narrative that you've invented and created to help to bring the readers into the environment of what life was like for women in the ancient world. So maybe you could just start by sharing with us a little bit about what do you think were some of the most important discoveries that you found in doing your work for the book?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. Probably one of the key things that at first surprised me and then made sense once I thought about it more often is that most women in the ancient Mediterranean basin, you know, the kind of Roman Empire, basically that geographical area, they wouldn't have been shut away behind closed doors most of their lives. I mean, we have some ancient literary sources that are written, of course, by men and almost always elite men who talk about women that way. But practically speaking, most families, most kinship groups wouldn't have had the luxury of kind of locking their women away. For people to survive in the ancient world, to get something to eat that day, almost everyone in the household would have had to contribute to making that happen. So you can't afford to have your women sitting behind closed doors unless they're doing things like weaving, maybe. And often that was a typical women's task, but women would have been out, you know, in urban areas, in the streets, in the marketplaces, doing things. They would have been exposed to a lot more, we think, than what scholars used to think, which is that women wouldn't have necessarily had that kind of interaction with their contexts. That's probably one of the things anyway.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, even in church settings, we've often hear an idea perpetuated that like, well, women in the ancient world weren't valued. Mm-hmm. They didn't really play any major role in society other than in the homes. Did you find anything that could speak to that particular thing about, because I think I've come across myself just some of the context, like in what's modern day Turkey, you know, at that point in the ancient world, it seemed like there were women who were definitely involved with even political roles. I mean, not to this extent that men often were, but they held positions of honor within the cities. They had wealth accumulated on their own. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you have anything that you discovered about that that can help to put into context some of those claims that are being made even from the pulpit about women's value in the ancient world?
Yep. I think the tendency has been for us to overgeneralize when it comes to women's roles. But what I'd like to do, at least partly through this book, is to nuance that a bit more, because in especially some urban centers, and actually we think that Rome in the first century and then Macedonia, places like Philippi would have had probably the most opportunity for women. I mean, the entire empire would have seen some women who, for example, came from wealthy families and even were able to hold on to that wealth if they married, and they would have had much more independence in that way because they would have been able to make some of their own choices. But even in places like Ephesus in Turkey, where I set my book, we know that there were women who were involved in various stages of the political process. And we know that there were women sometimes who were involved in as priestesses in the cult of Artemis, for example. So they would have had that kind of, I don't know, we might say power, kind of social capital that they could then spend in a variety of ways. So it's not a monolith in the ancient world. Some women clearly weren't valued very much and they weren't treated very well. But then we have enough evidence for women being on the opposite side of that, that that means that we need to kind of reconsider the whole picture and take the variety seriously.
So I'm curious, what got you into studying this subject?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I've been working on what I call the gender text in the New Testament since seminary, basically since I've known Justin, because my very first class, or basically a class during my first quarter in seminary, a male student told me that he wasn't sure if I had the right to be there because I was a woman. And I grew up in a context where women were, at least people talked about women as being capable and qualified and, you know, endowed by the Holy Spirit to do whatever they're called to do. So that was my first real encounter with a different perspective on what women can and should do.
So I think that just kind of passed by. You said that a classmate took you aside and said that he wasn't sure you should even be there.
Yes. I mean, he didn't really take me aside. He just kind of mentioned it as we were passing by each other in a class.
Okay.
So that began, honestly, I mean, I was so surprised and I didn't have anything to say to him in that moment. I didn't even respond. I just, I remember picking up my books because I had been sitting, or I was going to sit next to him. I picked up my books and I moved to a different part of the room because I thought, I can't be around him, but I don't even know what to say. But in that moment, I also thought to myself, never again will I have nothing to say. Yeah. So that began my research and investigation into the gender texts, you know, all the way basically in the New Testament, especially from Jesus' interactions with women to some of the things that Paul says about women, which tend to fall both kind of some in the more positive area and some that seem to be more restrictive. So that area of my academic work has been going on for a really long time. But I hadn't considered writing a book like this, where you get to sort of see life from the perspective of a woman in the ancient world. I hadn't considered that until I met an editor from University Press who asked me about my interest in writing a book like that.
Wow. That's super interesting. So it sounds like then this project helps to locate some of those texts that we find in the New Testament. Is that right?
Yes, it does. So I had passages, well, basically the whole kind of communal spiritual gift section in 1 Corinthians in mind, and some of the household code texts in books like Colossians and Ephesians in mind, especially the 1 Timothy text, because, you know, 1 Timothy is addressed to believers, or to Timothy in Ephesus, and then indirectly the church there. And the text that talks about women being saved through childbearing, that kind of thing. I had all those in mind in a kind of implicit way as I was writing this novel. Yeah.
That's super interesting. So I have not had a chance to read your book. So for people like me, here's what I'm picking up. It sounds like you've done a bunch of historical work and then you've made it narratively accessible to the reader. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. That's a very good description, especially for someone who hasn't read the book yet. I feel very good about the historical cultural work that I've done. And then this experience that my main character, this woman, has in the book is shaped by all of these, you know, frameworks and forces, just like we are shaped by frameworks and forces in our context that we don't always acknowledge, but they're still there. And they're still, you know, giving just contextual kind of meaning and space to how we live our lives. So I tried to show some of the variety of what women would have experienced, because my main character has, you know, female friends, for example, and then she meets Paul and Priscilla and Aquila. And we think that someone like Priscilla would have been on the higher end of what we might call the status ladder, or the kind of socioeconomic ladder in the ancient world. And she would have had maybe a little more access to some of the realities of ancient life than women on the kind of lower end would have. So I tried to give a sense of that in the book.
And it seems like it'd be interesting to hear from you what it was like going from the research then to the narrative. It's not often that scholars will venture away from the academic articulation to now let me write a story. Like, what was that like for you? Was that painful? Or
I'm still going at first, I got to tell you. I mean, I've never written a novel before, never even tried, but I love to read novels. That's what I do for fun, mostly, as my kind of, you know, downtime experience. So I've read probably thousands of novels, and I'm not exaggerating. Mm. But I'd never written one, and getting into the kind of process of it was slow at first. And I prayed so much. I would say, oh, Spirit of God, please empower, you know, if I had a window of time to write, I'd say, please empower me in the next 3 hours to get something productive done here, because I'm having a hard time kind of getting into the flow of it. However, after a while, I will say, I feel like I did get into the flow of it. And by the end of the book, I felt like I was watching something happen in my, I'm sure, spirit empowered imagination, because it wasn't just Holly's imagination, but it's like I was watching the scene unfold, and I was just typing it, trying to keep up with what I was seeing happening in my imagination. So the process got faster as I went along.
It sounds like it got fun too.
Oh, it did. It was fun. It was fun. Once I got into it, it wasn't very fun at first. And it's probably not the, you know, best novel that anyone's ever going to read in terms of being high level kind of fiction work. But I am proud of it. I think it's good. And the historical cultural work, I'm very, very proud of. I think it's great.
Well, and for our listeners, you know, spoiler alert, your book opens kind of with a bang. I mean, you have the scene of a woman giving birth, and then some of the things that you get into in terms of the way that she's processing the difficulties she's experiencing and wondering about Artemis and things like that. It's just a fascinating scene that I think it engages people in the first century environment in a way that traditional academic texts just just can't quite pull you there very easily. So I really appreciated that. Just you get this imaginative way of bringing people into those scenes and those environments. And it's accessible for people, I think, who normally wouldn't be picking up an extremely detailed academic work on it.
Yes.
Well, not that your academic work isn't rigorous. It certainly is. But yeah, it's like it more fits, like you see it behind the scenes and in some of the text box that you include more so than you do in just the narrative, which I appreciate.
Yeah, I included some of those text box to give more historical cultural information about the ancient world. Honestly, because my editor said, you can't put everything that people need to know about the ancient world into the narrative. It's going to make for a narrative. So you need these little sidebars so that people can get a little more information without slowing the narrative down or interrupting it. In terms of accessibility, I mean, my mom was my primary personal audience for this book as I was writing it. My mom loves the Bible, always has, and definitely modeled, my dad too, but definitely modeled that love of the Bible to her kids. And she doesn't have any formal theological training in her life, though she has me, of course, and I can ask questions. But I wanted to write something that she could read that would help her understand this Bible, this, you know, collection of texts that we call the Bible that she loves so much. I wanted her to be able to understand it in a bigger, deeper way. And I wrote this book primarily for people like her so that they can do that.
One of the things that it's interesting to me as I'm hopefully wrapping up my dissertation, the big chapter that I just submitted includes some counterfactual narrative as a way of doing analysis, historical analysis. And I think one of the things that's really interesting is how, I don't know, I'm thinking about the role of narrative in knowing, right? And we talked with Torsten Moritz a while back about critical realism and the role of creativity and how it sounds like what you were doing with this book is saying, okay, here, you know, you could give the reader all these facts about the ancient world, but it doesn't become accessible. You know, it's not something that they can then read into scripture for the most part, they can't use that to shape their imagination. I mean, there's this interesting epistemological thing happening. Yes. And the same kind of thing in my dissertation where it's like, I can say, okay, here are all these cultural factors and here's what actually happened, but it's writing the narrative of, well, what might've happened. And that's that creative leap that makes something accessible and accessible in a way that it wouldn't be otherwise. That's really interesting to me.
Well said. I agree with you. I think the primary way we understand our world is through stories, through narrative frameworks. That's how we make sense of things. And I'm hoping that this book will help people, even after they've read it, help people to, you know, when they come across a woman in the New Testament who might even just be briefly mentioned at one of the end of Paul's letters or something, that they'll have a whole story that can sort of accompany that and flesh that out for them and make that real for them in a way that before maybe it wouldn't have happened that way, because we're used to, honestly, I think people in the church are used to kind of skimming over, especially minor characters who don't get a lot of plot development. I'm hoping that this will bring to life some of those realities. And in terms of bringing to life, because my character is a mom, you know, and has already one child and then she's pregnant in the book, I've had a lot of women say to me that they felt so known and kind of loved through walking with my character in the book that way. And that was one of my goals too, to give the kind of weight and significance to this very common reality for women. I mean, not all women have babies, obviously, but a lot of women do. And to help them experience in a way that felt more personal, what it would have been like to be a woman in the ancient world and be in that space. And then to encounter Paul, for example, like what might the Jesus community and people like Paul have to say about this common women's experience of having babies?
And it seems like there's so much space that's spent looking at the 1 Timothy 2 passages and Ephesians 5 and those places when it comes to try to understand what the New Testament has to say about women or women's roles and things like that. But so many passages like Romans 16 with Phoebe and Priscilla and Junia, I mean, those are overlooked. Lydia and Acts. I mean, in some ways, what I appreciate about what you're doing as well is we know there are stories that underlie their names and the things that are said about them, even if they're brief in the New Testament, but we don't really have a lot of access to those stories. And sometimes an imaginative reconstruction along the lines of what you're doing can help put some flesh in some ways to the fact that those passages have as much to say to us, even when the details aren't maybe as detailed as the so-called teaching, passages. And so I really appreciate you taking the chance to unfold the narrative for the women in the ancient world that is more implied in the texts that we have them named in.
Yes, well said. It is implied or indirectly, you know, just yeah. So Jesus interacts with a lot of women in the Gospels, and hardly anyone gives attention to that because they focus on those few texts in Paul's letters where he didactically, you know, instructs the believers what to do about women. I'm sorry, but even like you said, even Paul has passages like Romans 16. We need to, to balance out some of this discussion so it's not one or two texts, usually Paul, that are then used to frame all the rest of the Bible's views on women. It's such an unbalanced approach. I don't buy it hermeneutically.
I don't either. are there any other things that you found in your research that you could say about just any other misconceptions that people tend to have about women in the ancient world that you were able to address or uncover in your research?
Mm-hmm. Let's see. That's a good question. I suppose in my research, I am aiming for a kind of middle ground here where people don't assume that women in the ancient world have nothing in common with women today in a context like the United States. But I also don't want people to think that women in the ancient world have, you know, everything in common with women today in a context like the United States. There's this kind of middle space where, of course, there are parallels. Women had female friendships and would have navigated through their lives, at least in some ways, through those kinds of gendered experiences, those gendered spaces. You know, that's where we think women would have talked about things like childbirth and getting pregnant and feeding their families, because food is almost always women's work in basically almost every culture and context, I think, that we know of. So women would have discussed those things and even shared resources within a broader kin group to support each other and help each other out. And of course, women have those experiences today. A lot of women talk about pregnancy and childbirth and food and what we're doing with the kids and all those kinds of things. So there's that, but then all these differences in terms of how most people would have acquired food. I mean, it's a day-to-day kind of thing. And of course, there are some contexts in the world today where they actually have more in common with women in the first century in the Mediterranean, because they are doing it on a day-to-day basis, trying to get something that day to eat. Whereas in contexts like the United States, most of us go to the grocery store, you know, once or twice or three times a week or whatever, and buy what we need. And we have that kind of extra and excess and convenience items, which people in the ancient world wouldn't have had for the most part. So I don't want to hit either one of the extremes. You know, we have nothing in common with them, or their lives were just like ours. It's this sort of middle space where some of the things we share and some we don't. And especially depending on context today and things like class.
No, I appreciate that balance there. I think I heard from one scholar something about how they believe that the distinctions, the social distinctions, were maybe even far more pronounced than gender distinctions were even in the ancient world in terms of roles and societal roles. Do you think that's true?
Yes, I do. From my research, I think that's true. Elite women would have probably in many ways had much more in common with elite men than they would have had with women who were much farther down the socioeconomic ladder, because their lives would have shared so many of those common, you know, parallels, things like not having to work every day in a trade, not having to prepare food, not having to directly care for children because slaves did that, not, you know, living in bigger spaces. The elites would have lived in much bigger spaces than most of the world or most of the population. So I think that's true from my research. Yes.
One thing I've wondered about too is even when people kind of want to talk mostly about the role that women played in sort of domestic spaces and the home, do you think that the fact that the New Testament church contexts were almost exclusively in homes or tenement buildings or small business meeting spaces, that has any implications for how we see ancient women's kind of role in participating in church communities because of the centrality of those churches existing in house spaces?
Yes, definitely. I mean, what we think of as a domestic space in most of the ancient Mediterranean world would have not just been domestic. It would have been a domestic kind of economic work-oriented space. So women aren't just, you know, making food and watching kids and hanging out there. In one of the characters in my book, who's a friend of my main character, she works with other women in her extended family group in the home, but they're working, they're weaving. And, you know, part of that process of making cloth, which was so expensive and time consuming in the ancient world. So they're home, sure, but they are contributing to the larger kind of family economic system in that way. And the men are also involved in that system. They just play a slightly different role. So because of the mixture of this, yes, it's much more complicated than just saying, oh, you know, yeah, women, they're in the domestic spaces, because the domestic space is so often overlapped with they're more work oriented, kind of outside the home spaces. And in my book, when Anthea, my main character, when she visits a basically a church gathering, a Jesus community, you know, gathering, it's in a shop that's around the edge of the marketplace area. And we think that a lot of these early communities of followers of Jesus would have met in spaces like that too, which is even more directly connected to, you know, outside work.
I'm curious, as you were going through the book and as you've reflected on it afterwards, what are some of the things that you see that you feel like we often misread? And I guess I don't know who we is. like if you think about the, maybe the church tradition that your seminary classmate might've come from, like, what are some of those misreadings that are happening because we've misimagined the context that scripture was written in?
Mm-hmm. Well, in this community of Jesus followers, there's this wealthy, prominent Jewish woman who is, you know, become a part of the Jesus thing. And she can read, for example, she's literate. And most people in the ancient Mediterranean world couldn't read, at least read long texts. Maybe they could, you know, read their name and write their name, but they weren't educated in that broader way. But we know some women were. And so, again, if we're going to overgeneralize and say, well, you know, women didn't have access to education, and so women wouldn't have been able to play a role in some of these, you know, in church communities or in synagogues or in even the kind of political structure. And that's all, of course, because women weren't valued, you know, then we end up in this space where people think, well, I guess, yeah, women, I mean, they weren't important and they didn't have access to anything, but we just know historically that's not true. The fact that in some of our sources, we know that some women, especially from wealthier families, were educated. And if they had a special relationship with their dad, the chances of that are even greater. And some of them did have access to resources and wealth that they could use to benefit the broader community. We actually see that in books like Luke's Gospel as well, in chapter 8, where the women are the ones financing the mission of Jesus. So again, I want to specify and kind of nuance some of that, so we don't work with these overgeneralizations where people say, well, you know, women weren't valued and they weren't educated, so of course they can't be teachers in the church. You know, thanks, Paul, for telling us that. Glad we know that now. It's just, that's such an unhelpful view, because it takes all this varied evidence we have and boxes it into a really kind of tiny picture.
I appreciate what you had to say about that. And there's, we could tackle so many different areas of this, because I've been in my Romans class and in working through other classes, I've been frustrated, I think, by seeing some of the ways that students are approaching First Timothy, the ways that they're approaching First Corinthians, the way that they're ignoring Romans 16 and other places. And I think I often wonder to what extent people's views about issues of like women in ministry and things like that are just simply a product of their own cultural understandings and actually participating in some bad hermeneutics than it is that they understand the scriptures and just want to stay committed to it. But that isn't to say that I think that the people who are holding those views aren't trying to at least be committed to what the Bible says, but it's some limitations sometimes in reading that cause them to prefer certain passages over others and ignore some of the things that you're bringing up. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate you raising that issue.
Well, to prefer, yes, or to choose one text as the, often people say clear text, like we're going to use texts in Paul that are clear, and then we're going to use those to help us understand the ones that are less clear. And I always think when people say that, why do you think that, you know, a certain text might feel clear to you and another one might feel unclear? Mm. It might have much more to do with you than what Paul was actually saying or doing there. So, you know, all these texts where Jesus interacts with women, apparently those are not the clear ones that help us understand the New Testament's view on women, even though that's Jesus. And we go to these two texts in Paul in 1 Corinthians 14, usually, and then 1 Timothy 2, and say these clear ones we're going to use to understand everything else. I just, hermeneutically, interpretively, I think there are big weaknesses with that kind of approach.
You probably remember well the WWJD movement, you know, with the bracelets and all. Did you ever have one?
Oh, of course I did in high school.
Oh, yeah. Oh, me too. Many of them, actually. I stacked them up. So what would Jesus do? On Twitter, I think I saw somebody say, you know, we should never ask WWJD. We should ask WDJD. Not what would Jesus do, but what did Jesus do? And in some ways, I was like, that makes sense. And this kind of relates to what you're saying, like our preference for Paul and our ignoring sometimes of the things that we don't think are clear, but that Jesus clearly does. It's a little bit appalling at times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a huge issue, and one that I think we need to constantly be working on and be aware of and be talking about with people, just so that they're aware that even is an issue. Mm-hmm. So to call into question someone's priority on 1 Timothy 2, where Paul says, you know, I do not permit a woman to teach or to, well, authentain, what is that, to have authority over, or to dominate a man, to even ask why someone might see that as the clearest text, the most helpful text that then gets used to understand the other ones. I think even asking the question can be helpful to raise the awareness of someone who might not ever have questioned why that is the primary text through which they then read everything else. Mm-hmm. This is important work.
Totally agree.
What did you feel like you, what did you learn about the American cultural context by looking at this other cultural context? Were there things that stood out as being really, unique about our context that maybe we do take for granted as we look at that?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a common kind of area that New Testament scholars and probably Old Testament scholars bring up, but the individualism of at least the kind of majority culture in the United States, you know, the culture or cultures here, it's much more diverse too than just a small kind of frame, but the way that we often live in a nuclear family kind of setup, and you know, the economic work of the household isn't directly often connected to the space where we live. People go to, well, with COVID, I guess a lot of more people are working from home. they're still doing a kind of task that might not be directly connected to their home because they would often go somewhere and do that somewhere else. And then seeing that family as independent and kind of taking care of themselves. And even talking to my friends, you know, a lot of us have kids, and the idea that we might get help from grandparents or something is just such a gift if you can get that once in a while. But in a context like the ancient Mediterranean, almost no one lived in nuclear family kinds of setups. And there would have been, the household would have been an extended group of people, many of whom would have been related to each other. But if you owned slaves, or if there were, you know, free people who were attached to the house in another way, maybe through that economic production, they would have had this much bigger group of people who would have been basically playing the role that often in our context, a nuclear family plays. So the ability for them to kind of share resources and help take care of each other. And again, for them, mostly it's a matter of survival. They have to take care of each other if they want to live. Like, that felt like such a big difference compared to what I have often experienced in the United States. Yeah. In this context. And it kept coming up again and again in my research about just the different kind of default that would have been for them, and how that would have influenced their lives and impacted their decisions.
It's interesting to think about how we have this kind of historical ethnocentrism, right, that we read back into the past, but also into the recent past. I mean, think about the denomination that Justin and I are affiliated with. The denomination made a change in the 90s about how it interprets women in ministry. And then now the understanding is that that's the conservative, you know, the traditional view of the denomination, when actually the traditional view of the denomination was much more, women were much more involved in more roles. And so we forget that. Yeah. And then thinking about, we do the same thing, looking back further, we read our small nuclear households into the New Testament in a way which they weren't there. And
Or even the independence that women are assumed to have in a context like the United States, you know, the freedom to make their own choices without having to, you know, consult a man or something. In the ancient world, even if a woman might have had the opportunity to make what we would call an independent choice, culturally speaking, to make a choice that just benefits you as yourself is considered inappropriate and shameful. Even you don't do that. You make decisions that are in the best interests of your primary group, whatever group that is. So often I think we wonder why some of these women in the New Testament, you know, didn't make better decisions. Why didn't she know how to take care of herself or know what to do? And there are so many cultural factors that are shaping the way that these women live their lives and even participated in the Jesus community.
I've also kind of wondered, it's interesting that in talking about the household situation in the ancient world, that we get a couple instances like Lydia in Acts where we're told that her household is baptized. Mm-hmm. And then we're said similar thing about Priscilla and Aquila in Romans, where it's their household. Yes. And I've always kind of been interested in that, because I think if we think of the idea of like the Roman man as the head of the house, which is, you know, a prevalent idea, is there some implications in the fact that Lydia's household's identified as hers and that Priscilla and Aquila's household's identified as theirs? It's not Aquila's household. Yeah. And, you know, so it's interesting, those little details like that, sometimes that can give us a window too into some of the complexities yes. of the situation in the ancient world. We don't think they're explicit, right? I mean, I do, but it's like a lot of people say, oh no, that's, you know, that's willy-nilly territory to stand on. But it's like, yeah, but those things matter.
They do matter. And when Priscilla and Aquila get described as being teachers, for example, and when they, mm-hmm. example, and when they teach Apollo in Acts, Priscilla is often listed first. And most scholars, no matter where they fall in the gender kind of discussion, mm-hmm. most scholars are going to say that's probably because she was the more prominent teacher and probably the better educated one. That was a typical way to mm-hmm. kind of frame that for people. But in a 21st century North American context, we might miss that. Whereas in the ancient mm-hmm. world, you know, if someone's hearing this text read or reading it themselves, if they can read, they would notice that she's mentioned mm-hmm. first as a teacher and they would know what to do with that. But we can miss that signal because we're... Mm-hmm. We're not ancient people. This is a bless our hearts moment for sure. Oh, 21st century people, we missed it.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode. Part two of the conversation with Holly gets into more questions of practical application for today and was really fascinating to us. Our theme music is by Josiah Enns. Reed Peters is a recognized patron of the show. We hope you can join us for coffee again next time.